Good morning, everyone. My name is Tom. I'm an alcoholic. I'm also very privileged to serve Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous as, and I'm going to try and remember my new title, Western Canada Pacific Regional Trustee on the General Service Board of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's such an honor to have been kind of in tongue-in-cheek, been given that little handle last night at a meeting. To have that opportunity to be here this weekend and experience the hospitality and the love that you people have shared, not only with each other, but with me. And it's just been a wonderful experience. And I'd have to begin by thanking Dick, who originally, back at the conference in April, asked if I would be available, possibly available for this weekend, to come to this assembly, the regional trustee being busy somewhere else. And I couldn't believe my good fortune to have an opportunity to come out here. And my calendar was open, and so here I am. And I'd like to thank Tricia and Dick and all of the people that I've been talking to and emailing over the last number of months as we've been preparing to come here. And everything's just been awesome. And that assembly yesterday, you people have something very, very special here in Area 72. You do. I'm sure you know it, but I need to tell you that as well. And I was talking with, on Thursday night, I was talking to a former past trustee from this region, and I was talking to him about something unrelated to coming here. And I happened to mention in the conversation that I was coming here. It's Greg M., who is currently your General Service Office Manager. And he said to please make sure and send his greetings and his love to you people here. He said this is one of his favorite areas. When he was a regional trustee, he has a real warm spot in his heart for this area. I understand why, and it wasn't just a nice comment that he was making. You people really have something special here. And to be able to come and spend some time with a good friend that I've served for 2 years on the General Service Board with, your former delegate and your former regional trustee, Phyllis, has been another one of the highlights of the weekend. So allowing me to participate in that election process yesterday, that spiritual process. Anyway, thank you. And for all of the love and encouragement that I've just been receiving here. It's just been awesome. Anyway, where to begin? I am an alcoholic. I came to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous on November 14th, 1983, and I count that as my sobriety anniversary. I grew up on and I still live on the prairies in Saskatchewan, Western Canada, about 1,400 miles east of Vancouver, if that helps you in any way at all. And I grew up on a small little farm on the prairie. I was the eldest of two sons that was born to a farm couple, and my father farmed, and my mother was a homemaker, and my grandfather, my maternal grandfather, lived with us as I was growing up. And my next sibling was 5 years younger than me, so for the first 5 years of my life, I had the distinction of being an only child in a family with three parents, so I suppose there was probably an opportunity to develop some self-centered tendencies there, I would imagine. And my grandfather, since my dad and mother were both busy, my grandfather and I grew quite close. He was retired, and he was also a drinker. And I don't know if I would call him an alcoholic, but he certainly liked to drink. And he was half my maternal side of my family are Irish Catholic. And my grandfather, he was sort of your stereotypical Irish gentleman. He was charming, witty, but when he had that first drink, something happened to him and he changed. But that always reminds me of just a little bit of a joke or story that I heard one time or read somewhere, where there was this fellow on the bus, he was riding the bus, and there was a gentleman sitting ahead of him, and he overheard him talking. And the fellow was talking with a real brogue accent. So the fellow tapped him on the shoulder and said, "I can't help but notice," he said, "you're speak with a real brogue accent," he said. You must be Irish, eh?" And the guy turned around and looked at him and he said, "No. Well," he said, "I used to be." But he said, "I haven't had a drink in 10 years. My first memories and recollections as a youngster growing up were feelings of fear and, I don't know, not fitting in, I guess, not belonging. I never did have that ease of mixing with people. I heard a phrase in Alcoholics Anonymous since I've been here that really, really helped me with understanding that feeling of being different, less than. And I heard a speaker one time use the phrase, "fear of being found out." And I wondered about that. Found out, because I'm not doing anything today in my life, thanks to AA, that I have any need to have a fear of being found out of. But I understand now what he meant. It's that fear of, well, if you really get to know me, or if I don't just say the right thing, or if I'm just don't meet your expectation, or whatever. And it was unspoken for so many years. And in fact, it's still with me today. I still get glimpses of it. This weekend, for example, I've had so many people say, "I'm really looking forward to hearing you share your story on Sunday morning." And you see, it's been really easy. It's been really easy for me to do the things that I was asked to do here this weekend because I've been able to prepare for them. But I don't prepare for this in the same sense. So somebody would say that and I would just get that little in my stomach. Oh, God. Fear of being found out. Oh, yeah. You're going to hear me on Sunday and you're really going to, you know. And maybe you will, who knows. But at one time that controlled me. At one time that prevented me from engaging in life. Today, I have to feel a feeling occasionally, but it doesn't prevent me from doing what I'm asked to do. Growing up with that isolation or that feeling of conscious separation, that's another term that I really like, is a very lonely place to be. And when you can't be connected for whatever reason, whether it's fear, whatever it is, it prevents me from having a relationship with you, whatever that is, when I can only go so far, then it's just automatic that it'll... whatever it is that I'm looking for turns back inside of me. And that's my understanding of self-centeredness. And that's really what I was, although I didn't know that until I got to AA. And when I got into my adolescent years and I got old enough to have the opportunity to drink alcohol in a setting that wasn't controlled in some way or other, I thought I had discovered the answer to all of my problems. Because when I had a drink, those inhibitions and fears, whatever they were, they didn't disappear totally, but they were diminished and removed to the extent that I could reach out and interact with people, my peers, feel a part of, feel like I belong to something. And I believe that that is an essential human need, and particularly in those adolescent years. I really believe that. And alcohol helped end that isolation. Now, I don't remember my very first drink because, as I said, I grew up in a home where alcohol was used. It was part of our social fabric. I had no fear of it. My grandfather was a binge drinker, but I had nothing to fear from it. It was a normal, natural part of our environment. But one thing that was very apparent to me right from the very beginning was that I drank differently. Now, I don't know about you, but I didn't grow into a problem drinker. Some of you may have, but I didn't. My very first experience drinking in that environment was different. And I had a very good example. I turned 16. I got my driver's license. That's all exciting, exciting things. My father trusted me enough to give me the family car. And I picked up my friend, good friend, and we were going to go to the show in the city 30 miles away. And you might wonder why going to the show would require each of us to buy a Mickey of whiskey. I don't know. It seemed like it was part of it all then. Is there a term down here for Mickey? Is that? No? It's a little bottle, anyway. The little bottle you can put in here. What do you call that? Half pint? Okay. We each bought a half pint of whatever it was, eh? And down the road we went. And I can remember clearly today, we were only maybe halfway to where we were going. And mine had about that much left in it. And his had about that much gone out of it. And I remember looking at him, and I noticed the difference. And I remember the look on his face. He noticed the difference as well. And I thought he was either being cheap or showing off or trying to make me look bad, or I don't know. I couldn't understand it, and he couldn't understand me either. But something happened to me every single time that I ingested a drink of alcohol. It immediately set up a desire to chase that sense of ease and comfort that they talk about, to chase it. Mindless of anything else that might get in the way. And that was to be my pattern. And that very first night, I ended up getting sick in the back of the family car, blacking out, and my friend had to take me home. And that was the beginning of my career. And not a lot changed in terms of the patterns that occurred from that point on, when I was given an opportunity to do that. I left home after graduation, and I lived on a small family farm. We're 100 miles away. There was really nothing to keep me there. And I left home after graduation, And I remember the date. I remember the day I left home. I had absolutely no sense or idea of, I had no confidence in my abilities. I was totally filled with fear of what I was going to do, where I was going to go. But I was encouraged to move to the city and go to school, and I did, and thank God for those people in my life that provided that direction for me in those years. But I remember leaving that yard that day, and it was almost like I was getting a tooth pulled as I was being pulled away from that security of home and going God knows where. Eh? But I took my security with me, of course, and that was, I knew what alcohol would do for me and what it did for me. Moved to the city, went to school, continued to drink, stopped, got a job, kind of fast-forwarding along there. 1972, about age 20, 21, met a young lady, and we got pregnant shortly after, not very long after meeting. And in those days, and probably still today, a lot of people do, but in those days, you got married. And we got married in the fall of 1972, and I can assure you I was about as emotionally equipped to make a commitment to become a husband and a soon-to-be father as you could possibly be. And I really believe that God does for us what we can't do for ourselves long before we get to AA. I really, because it was, as I said, but in spite of that, we made that commitment and we started down that path. But one of the beautiful things about that chance occurrence was that this young lady that I met, her father, was sober for 5 years in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was my introduction to AA, like to what AA is. And I have to say that that man, for the time that we were married and those first few years, he would talk about AA and he would talk about his experiences, and he never, ever once suggested that I needed it or pushed it on me. But he would always have that different kind of look on his face when I would be hungover or suffering. And it wouldn't be one of derision or contempt. It was one of compassion. And he'd have that kind of that knowing smile on his face. He understood. He understood me. He didn't see me as a failure and a drunk. He saw me as an alcoholic. And I'm so grateful that he did that and that he expressed himself in that way, because he could have easily turned me off of AA, easily. Having a family of my own, I don't know how objective I could be in a situation like that. But he was, anyway, he was. And so we continued on our journey, and my drinking was still my solution. But I used to sit and listen to him talk about AA, talk about it. He'd share, and he was a low bottom. He was a low bottom. And I could listen for hours and hours and hours, and I just admired this thing so much. And I got to meet lots of his friends. We'd go to family birthdays and that sort of thing at his group. And I can remember saying one time, "This is, the whole world could use what you people have. You people." I said, "You people." I could never, ever, ever make that connection that was something that I needed or could use. But see, alcohol was still my solution. I was still not at that point where this solution of mine was going to rob me of every single thing that I held valuable. So we continued on our journey. A couple of years later, we moved out to a little community of about 400 people, 1975, and it's where I still live today, little town of Vibank, Saskatchewan. And it might have been a geographical cure, but we were also both from the country, and we were looking for a place to raise our family. We had a son, our firstborn was a son. He came into our life, and so out to Vibank we went, and of course, the nature of alcoholism being what it is and what we all know it to be, it's progressive. It's a progressive illness, and it continues to get worse. And I've been told, and I believe, that even when I'm not drinking, the disease continues to progress in me. And that if I have the misfortune to take a drink at some point down the road, I won't be starting back here. I'll be starting where I would have been. I don't have any fear of doing that. But it's my drinking patterns changed. I started to drink more frequently rather than just on a weekend. I'd start find myself drinking on the way home. See, I commuted 30 miles. I still do. A 30-mile commute through the country to the city where I work, 30-mile commute home again. And I would find myself buying a six-pack for the road home. And so I started drinking during the week, doing things, patterns that I really looked down upon in other people. When I would see other people doing them, I would find myself starting to do them. For example, coming home the next morning, I used to think that was a terrible thing. And I would find myself, one day I found myself coming home at 6 o'clock in the morning. And being raised with values, as most of us are, and morals, the contradiction between how I was living my life and what I knew to be true and right was getting wider and wider and wider. And bear in mind that fear of being found out was a huge, and still is, a big part of my thinking, the thinking part of my illness. So at that time, I was doing things that I bloody well better be afraid of being found out about. So here you are, you're living in this little community where everybody knows you, and you are living a double life, and you're attempting to be a civic-minded community person, a father, a churchgoer, all of these sorts of things. And on the other side of the coin, fear of being found out. And I'd be walking down the sidewalk and somebody would be coming towards me. They'd smile and say good morning and say, "The hell does he know?" You know? Oh, it's a horrible, awful way to live. It's an awful way to live. Terrible way to live. God. And through all of those years, because of my drinking and because of that fear that was my constant companion, that relationship between my wife and myself grew further and further apart. And there came a day when I discovered that there was an attempt to change the locks on the door one day. And some of those little telltale signs that tell you. And that fear of being found out, and my worst possible nightmare and fear was losing my family, to have my wife leave me. And it was that fear that really contributed in a huge way to our marriage ultimately ending, because I had so much of that fear that I hung on so tight and controlled so much. I mean, I have no trouble understanding, looking back, how things happened the way they did. But I'd like to say that I came to AA for purely altruistic reasons. You know, I suddenly one day had a flash, and I saw AA for what it is, and I want to aspire to grow spiritually and join that wonderful fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's how I used to tell it at one time, I think. But if I'm being really, really honest, it was pure self-interest and fear and nothing else that drove me here. And finally drove me to that point of tearing off the scales off of my eyes, that I could really, really see clearly what was happening and what was at play. And it took the example that I just never want to forget. It was one of those Saturday mornings that I came home at 6 in the morning. And I'd been out all night and picking my way into my own house on Main Street in broad daylight, thinking it was still a secret. I live on the corner of Main Street and 2nd Avenue. There's a 4-way stop right outside my house. Every car that goes by has to stop, and I'm thinking that nobody knows anything, eh? And I open that door and walk into the porch. And there, standing at top of the 3 stairs, was my 5-year-old daughter at the time. And we went on to have 2 daughters after our son was born. And so my 5-year-old daughter was standing there, and it was a picture that was just, she was standing there with her white nightgown on. She had her teddy bear in her arm. And she was looking at me, and her eyes were red. And she'd been up all night with her mother, going from window to window to window, looking, where's Dad, and wondering. And I walked through the door, and I saw that. And at that moment, a higher power had an opportunity to get past that denial that had prevented me from seeing the harm that I was causing to the people that I loved the most. See, I didn't think that I was hurting anybody else, because I didn't lose my job. I didn't have the misfortune to lose my job or my license. The bills were paid. All of those sorts of things, all of that stuff was in a row. And I had no idea. I would hear my wife talk about my drinking and complain about my drinking, and we would, but it never, ever registered. My defenses were always, well, whatever. I'm not like your dad, or I'm doing all of the right things here. Like, what are you complaining about? But that morning got me. And between the guilt and remorse that I felt for what I now saw to be the harm that I was doing to these innocent people, in addition to that fear of actually losing them. So that morning, I made a decision not to come to AA. No. I'm going to quit. I'm going to quit. That's what I'm going to do. And I did. I quit drinking for a month and a half. Thank God that's all it was. And life got better. Life got better. It really did. Just the simple act of stopping drinking. And I can remember, you know, the coming home on time and the shame and guilt, and a lot of those things started to diminish and go away. And I really thought that was all that the problem was my drinking. How would I know any different? And a month or two later, I can't tell you just how long, but I had an opportunity, and I wasn't thinking about drinking, wasn't planning on drinking, wasn't, oh, I can't wait till that day my brother gets married and then I'll have an excuse to drink. None of that. I was in the wedding party. I wasn't planning on having a drink. I had no fear of taking it, but I wasn't planning on it. It just happened. Just why not? Why wouldn't I? It's a special day. And that started me right back on the path that I had stepped off of briefly. But the difference being this time, I knew I do not have the luxury of continuing in this fashion. I do not. And I will lose what I have. So I remember making a decision and telling my wife, the next time that I go on a drunk, the next time, if that happens again, I will go and I will sign myself in to a rehabilitation center. In my mind, when I told her that, I knew very well, I knew full well that that was going to happen, and that was just a matter of time. And it was. And I made those arrangements, and I entered that treatment center November 14th, 1983, and that was my introduction to this wonderful way of life that we share. And I had been to many AA meetings, as I mentioned earlier, with my family, with my father-in-law for birthdays. And I never, ever had any connection there. I admired what you were all doing. I was just kind of a little bit turned off with your honesty, you know, that sharing and that, oh, God, that kind of stuff. You know, I thought, that's, for somebody as smart as I thought I was, you know, that's nice for you folks. But I probably don't need that. Anyway, but in that center, I started going to AA meetings. That was part of the regimen. And I'll never forget that first AA meeting that I went to after I had surrendered. And I walked into that AA meeting, and I believe it was a 10-year birthday. And I found that feeling that I had been searching for my entire life. I couldn't believe it. And I thought I found it occasionally in those first 3 or 4 minutes after having a drink. That feeling, sense of ease and comfort, that sense of belonging and fitting in and all of that. And I found it in those rooms. And that feeling, and that I call that feeling love today, that unconditional love that we show each other, and particularly newcomers, is what's kept me coming back to the meetings, to Alcoholics Anonymous, since that time. Because that's all I was ever looking for, was a sense of wholeness, a sense of fitting in, a sense of belonging to something, being a part of. I went to AA, completed that program, and I went to AA. I was so inspired yesterday by the number of people who, when they had an opportunity to share, they would say, I've been coming to servicing since I was 6 days sober or 6 weeks sober, or I, you know, all of those things. And I'm just so in awe of when I hear that. I'm envious, actually, because living in that small community, there was no AA in Vibank at that particular time. And so I got the idea. I went to AA when it was convenient. Now, that the importance of that welcome, I could never, ever underestimate. That welcome, keep coming back, because that kept me coming back. But I went to AA meetings on a regular basis, but it was when it was convenient. I'd do it according to my schedule. I never got a home group to start with, for that reason. I still had that huge fear of getting close to people. I would go to those meetings, and as soon as the amen was still echoing off the walls, I'd be out the door. People would say, come for coffee, what are you doing? I'd always have an excuse or a reason. I couldn't make that connection, that you were really serious and that you really meant that, that you're just being nice to me. I couldn't make that connection. So for the first 2 or 3 years of my sobriety, that was my experience. And I had the opportunity finally, again, God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself, And after about 3 years of sobriety, I had the opportunity, through a phone call from a person I'd never met in a neighboring town, to start a group. He was tired of driving 40 miles to a meeting every day. He got my number, and to make a long story short, my home group will be celebrating 20 years in January of 2007, that little meeting in that little town of 400 people. And that man is still a member of that home group, and we still... And that meeting is, I go out the side door of my house, that same door that I picked my way into years ago, and I go across the street to about where that door over there is and down a set of stairs into a church basement. That's how well cared for I am. And the notorious prairie winters, where you sometimes hear about 40 below zero and wind and snow, and well, it's true, that's how it is. But I like to boast that I don't even have to put a coat on to go to my home group. Even on the worst winter day, it's just across the street and down the stairs. And that group gave me an opportunity to start becoming a part of the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this man that phoned was involved in service previously, and he sponsored our group into general service right away. So I then started going with him. He didn't say, you should go, it'll be good for you. He said, I'll take you. And we started going to district meetings, area assemblies, regional forums, and that's where I had the opportunity to start to get into recovery. And so I've talked a lot about step one. And step two, for me, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I thought that was going to be a real easy one. Well, that's a snap. Because I was raised, as I said, I was raised in a family. I was raised in a church-going family. I knew about God. I guess the easiest way of explaining it today, I had belief. Belief I had, it was faith that I didn't have. And I didn't know that at that time. But I thought, oh yeah, came to believe. That means that's, you know, I don't need to look for God. I've already got that, eh? And I was also still under the impression that these steps, I wanted to do the steps, but I didn't have any concept that it was a doing thing. I thought it was an understanding thing. I want to study these things. Because if I study them and understand them, figure out how they work, then I can apply that. Then I can apply that to my life, fix myself. And I'm embarrassed to say that it took me many, many, many years to come to understand that the purpose of these steps is action. And each one of them shows me a specific action to take in order to get a result. And even if I don't believe that the result is going to happen, even if I just go through the physical motions of doing it, you can't prevent the change from happening. And I miss that. I miss that. And today I believe that a big part, all of maybe, step two, is about removing those prejudices and those things in my mind that prevent me from taking that next step, and that is getting involved in the actual action of the steps 3, 4, and on. Because as long as I thought it was my thinking that was going to do it, I wasn't going to get very far. No action, no results. Looking for God. I loved a line I heard somewhere. Someone said, don't have to look for God. Why not? Because he ain't lost. You know? And something else, and this might not be related to step two totally, but I heard it recently, and I'm just going to share it with you. There were these two fish swimming around in Puget Sound. And one of them said to the other one, "You know what? I heard a really interesting word or concept the other day. Somebody said, 'I believe in water.' What is water? Well, let's look for it." So they spent 6 months swimming around the Pacific Ocean looking for water. Okay, forgive me if that doesn't quite fit here, but that to me was... That was profound. That was profound. For me, it was profound. Because I can spend my entire life running around looking for something that is I'm surrounded with. And all that I have to do is be able to get past that barrier, that imaginary barrier between you and me. And that's what these steps do. That's what these steps allow me to do, is take the action that allows me to... I can't be in myself. I cannot be here when I'm attempting to be of service to you. When I'm attempting to add to your life, when I'm attempting to add to the lives of people around me in whatever fashion I cannot be in two places at once. I can't be living in here when I'm in the action of doing this. So, those of you who are here today and who are involved in service and have been sponsored into this, know as well, you know how fortunate you are. And I know how fortunate I am to have been given an opportunity to learn that. I could have read this book. I could have been sitting and still reading today, 22 years later. And it would have been wonderful reading, but it never would have shown me what the action program of these steps has shown me. Step three for me, I believe, for me, at one time I used to think step three was making a decision to turn my will over, like, okay, I'm going to surrender. Here's my will. And that was really what it was about. I'm going to let go. I'm going to turn it over. But it's letting go and turning it over is one thing, but how come it's always right back in front of me? So it's not an intellectual exercise. And I'm, again, embarrassed to tell you how long it took me to come to understand that. And today I believe that step three is, after coming to believe in step two, that there's a power of some sort or other. Step three is making that decision, okay, I believe that there's something here, that there's a power here. I can see it. I can feel it. So I'm going to make a decision to move on into the actual nuts and bolts of the action that comes in step four. A little example of coming to believe for me. My marriage ended very early in sobriety, within the first few months of sobriety. And not as a result of planning or legal affairs or anything. The way it unfolded, by simply stepping back and letting go, both of us, it ultimately happened that those three children, who were at that time 5, 7, and 10, ended up staying in the family home, and I ended up staying in the family home. And I ended up being given the gift of being the custodial parent in a joint, I forget the term, arrangement. We were both involved fully in their upbringing, in their lives, but I was the one that was blessed with the opportunity to be that in-house parent. And I can remember one Tuesday night, and for those of you who have had the privilege of being a single parent or with those responsibilities will know that there are days when there's a lot of bases to cover. Let's put it that way. And this one particular Tuesday evening, Tuesday night, 8 o'clock, my home group, I come home that day, and I don't know what was going on. Likely overtired, because that's sort of the story of my life. Overtired, overburdened, resentments, fears. I have no idea. But I can distinctly remember leaving that house to go to that meeting. Oh, yeah, 8 o'clock. Yeah, well, there's something about a commitment to a home group, let me tell you. So it wasn't even a question. I'm going to the meeting. And these kids are at the door to see me off. And they're kids. They're loving kids. And they're there. They want to give me a hug. They want to. And I could literally and physically hardly stand that. I had nothing in me. It was just all I could do to do whatever and go. And as I'm walking that block and a half, the meeting was at a different place then. As I'm walking that block and a half down to that meeting, I get to the meeting room and I walk into that meeting room. And before I even see anybody or say anything to anybody, I immediately feel myself starting to change. But the people start coming and the meeting happens. And I'm walking home an hour and 15 minutes later, and I am consciously aware of being a totally different person. I can't wait to get home. I see the light, I see the heads in the window, and I can't wait to get there. And I can't wait to hug them, and I can't wait to talk to them, and I can't wait to do all of those things. There was a power. I don't need to understand how it works or what it is. That's not important. I understand that there was a power of some sort in that whole process of me going to that meeting, letting you people, going and hanging out with a bunch of people that love me and accept me just for the way I am. And that changed my sense of that power and coming to believe that there is something, a power that's beyond me. And that just, I went on and I did my fourth step. And my first fourth step was, again, bear in mind, this is still, the directions are there. Yeah, sure. Okay, I'll do it. You know, like somebody tells you, you have this recipe for a, you have this awesome cheesecake or dessert you've had somewhere. It's the best you've ever had, and you say, can I have the recipe? They say, sure, here it is. And it's spelled out minutely, and everything's in detail and order. And you go home, and you want to duplicate that awesome experience you had, and you immediately set out to change the ingredients. Oh, well, I'll change this. I won't put quite that much in. I'll turn the temperature down a little bit. Really, that sounds ludicrous, but that's exactly what I'm doing when I decide that I'm going to disregard the recipe and I'll just try it myself. Well, I did that. And you know what? You guys don't care. You understand. You don't say, you got it wrong, or you got to leave now until you get it right. That was my first four-step experience, and I've had many of them since. And today, what that process showed me, it wasn't an immoral thing. It wasn't an exercise in finding out how bad a person I was, which is what I thought at the beginning. It was an exercise in trying to show me, through cause and effect and connection, that what the problem really was. And for me, in the entire column, all the way down, was fear. Fear, 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 fear. Oh, yeah, I could use other words like pride or whatever, but it would always distill and wash out to fear at the bottom. My fifth step, sharing with another, with that other individual, I remember that experience, the first time, the relief I felt in admitting. And there's something about the act of admitting. Admit is a word that comes to play in a number of our steps, beginning with the first one. There's some kind of a freedom and a power in admitting something to somebody. admitting I'm powerless, admitting in the fifth step, admitting in the tenth step. For a long time, I thought step 10 had to do with apologizing. I hurt somebody or I made a mistake and I have to apologize. Well, that's part of it. But I believe today that the most important element in that 10th step is the admitting. When I foul up, it's important for me to find somebody that I can trust and just tell them, this is what I did. This is what I said. And sometimes it can even be an example of gesturing at somebody in traffic, for example. And I can't ever find that person and make an amend to them for that. But I don't have the luxury of carrying that around in me with me either. I don't want to be that way. So, step six, getting to step six and being entirely ready to have God remove our shortcomings. That was another misconception for me. I still had this idea that, you know, all of those other things about me that I didn't like, those habits, those whatever, that I was eventually going to learn how to handle those here in AA. That if I just did the program right and didn't drink long enough, I'd be able to be free of a lot of those things, whatever they are, resentment, anger, other habits. And I didn't know that this step is not about getting something perfect before I move on. It's about just becoming entirely ready and acknowledging that my willpower is not going to be any more successful with any of these other character shortcomings than it was with drinking. And to not get hung up on that idea that I have to get it right here before I can move on. So the 12 and 12 calls says something about it separates the men from the boys as in step six. So for me, step six is moving on to the rest of the steps and just not being too hung up about all of these other extraneous issues that are attached to me. And I learned that lesson really well in saying yes to an opportunity to speak at a roundup many years ago, similar to this, smaller but similar. And getting up there and really feeling like a phony that particular day before I was about to speak, I thought, what the heck am I doing here, you know? If you only knew that just how unrecovered I still am, you know? If you only knew that. And yet here I'm supposed to be telling you how wonderful it is and how wonderful I am, and totally, totally missed it. And I was staying at the home of a bachelor friend of mine at that time. He's not a bachelor anymore, but he had there was a grapevine sitting on his table, and it was 1987, and this had been in the mid-90s. It was stuck to the table, and that's why it was still there, I guess. He must have used it. It takes what it takes. And I picked up that grapevine and I started to thumb through it. And here there was an article in there on step six that I needed to read. And I needed to drive 10 hours up there, sit in his dingy little trailer to learn that lesson. But if I had not said yes to that invitation, if I'd have said to myself, no, I'm going to wait till I'm well and better before I say yes to any of these opportunities that I'm given or things that I'm asked of, I'd have missed out. All the way along, I'd have missed out. This isn't about getting well and getting better and then going out there and offering all of that to AA. Maybe indirectly that's part of it. But the whole act of service is recovery. And it's in that action of service and giving it away that we actually do recover. And step seven really amplifies that clearly for me. And that's step seven prayer. Remove from me every single defect of character. And that isn't where the period comes. That stand in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. And it doesn't say remove all of them that stand in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. For me, that step prayer, seven-step prayer, is a guarantee that I don't need to be afraid or be worried about any of those things that, oh, I really better not say yes to this or that because of this or that. I've come to believe and know with a certainty that my higher power will remove those things that prevent me from being of service to you, those people around me. And it doesn't say that he's going to take away all of those things that cause me discomfort, you know, that fear of being found out that I was talking about earlier that I've been experiencing on and off over the course of this weekend, you know, and often do. Though he didn't tell me that that's going to be taken away. It may be someday, but it hasn't been yet. But any of the things that actually prevent me from being of service and being of use to you and the people around me have been removed. And I just love that prayer, and I love the spirit of that step. Step 8 and step 9. Well, step 8, I believe, for me is the willingness, having that willingness to make those amends that I owe people. And in coming to that state of willingness, I find that as I become more and more willing to make those amends, I can't hang on to resentments and anger and things towards the person that I'm going to make that amend to. And when it comes time to make that amend, I find that all of those things have fallen away, and I go to that person, and I'm able to make that amend in a loving spirit. And the major amend that I had to make in my life, the major one, was to my former wife. And fear prevented me for years from doing that. Not from being willing to make it, but from making it. And I would have all kinds of scenarios play out in my mind. Oh yeah, if I go and make this amend, reach out, make that amend, this'll happen and that'll happen and I better not and I'll wait. But thank God, though it was just the willingness. I'd come back and we go through the steps in a cycle in our group. And every time we'd come around to step 9, I'd kind of slide down in my chair. Oh yeah, now I have to tell them again that, no, I haven't made that amend yet. And they would just say, well, continue to pray for the willingness. They didn't say, you should, or you better, or what's the matter with you, or they might have thought it, but they were kind enough. They were kind enough not to say it. And eventually, an opportunity came when I was able to make that amend. And we were able to sit across from each other, and I was able to hear that her say to me, it wasn't all you. And I thought it was. So step 10 is, it's a daily continue to take personal inventory. Continue to, upon awakening. And I have to confess, the lifestyle that we sometimes lead in terms of shortening the sleep part, you know, commitments, I have to be honest and say that sometimes my prayer at the end of the day is a thank you as I roll over on my pillow. And sometimes the morning one is sometimes the meditation books, I go buy them as I go. I go buy them to the bathroom, and then I'm thinking, I'll pick those up now, and I'll sit down, and I'll do that now. And as soon as I'm getting up from there, I'm thinking of three other things, so I go buy them again. And I'm not saying I do this all the time, but this often happens. And on my good days are the days when I've stopped, picked those books up, sat down, and taken 5 minutes. But I'm blessed, really blessed, in that I live 30 miles out in the country from where I work. And every single morning for the last 30, well, even when I was drinking, I'm going to say for the last 33 years, but for the last 22, almost 23 years, God was doing for me what I wouldn't have done for myself. And that is, he's provided me every morning with a 40-minute drive by myself across the rolling prairies of southern Saskatchewan. And I get to watch the seasons change every day as I'm going. And I leave home for work about 5:30 in the morning, so there's very little traffic. And it's not that long ago that I came to realize that I used to think I don't take enough time, I don't do this, I'm not working that step, that I have been. That quiet time. And when I wake up in the morning, I don't know about you, but I am not what one of those boundless, energy-filled, what is that term that people use? Upon awakening, no matter how well-rested I might be, oftentimes the first thoughts that come to my mind are thoughts of either things I have to do or anxiety about things that I need to do or outcomes of things. That just seems to be there with me when I wake up most of the time. But it's never failed me yet. As soon as I open that door, step outside into nature and start down that road, by the time I get 30 minutes later to the city, I have perspective. Whatever I thought was the problem, whatever it was, here, by the time I'm in there, it's back down to its right size. A good friend of mine recently shared that he did an exercise with himself over the course of 1 year. He would make a notation every time he thought of a situation or thought of something that he was afraid of, anxious about the outcome, you know, whatever it might be, anxiety about something or other. He'd make a note of it. And he kept a journal of it. And he said, at the end of the year, I went back and reviewed that journal. And he said, you know what? Not one single item on that list that he had, that anxieties and fears and outcomes that he had penciled in, not one of them came true. And I thought to myself, that was profound for me. That was profound because what it showed me was the amount of time in my life and in my day that I'm given, that I have squandered, that I can squander when I'm living in fear of outcomes in the future. They hardly ever materialize. So I wouldn't have learned any of these things. I wouldn't have learned any of these things if I would not have been sponsored into the full program of Alcoholics Anonymous, all three legacies, recovery, unity, and service, which I believe are one thing, which I believe are three parts of one thing. I'd have missed that. So when I said yesterday how excited I am for those of you who are, for all of you, but for those of you in particular who are new and who are just starting out on this journey, I meant it. Because I know what's awaiting you when you stay on this path and continue to suit up and show up and make yourself available and look for opportunities to add to the lives of people around you, both in AA and outside of AA. And the 12th step, I believe, is not only a 12th step in Alcoholics Anonymous and with the suffering alcoholic, but it's a 12th step in my home, it's a 12th step in business, it's a 12th step in the community, and it's a 12th step right here. And it's all about, what can I do to add to your life? What can I do to add to? And as I'm busy asking that question and looking for opportunities to do that, I am given that freedom from that lonely place that I would automatically go to if I wasn't on this path. By golly, we've come to our time. A couple of just really brief little things here that have been profound little items for me. I heard a person say, it's not important to me what you think of me. What's important is what I think of you. And that fits with adding to. These things, when I think about them, change the way I feel. Just really turns it around for me. And another one that was way too simple, I thought, for somebody as smart as I thought I was. He said, this business of living is kind of like breathing. He said, in order for it to be life-giving, you have to be taking it in and giving it away. Taking it in and giving it away. You can't do just one of them. And he said, if you don't believe me, try it for a little while. I wouldn't have heard or learned any of those things anywhere else. And I think of the people that go to monasteries and spend lifetimes studying these spiritual principles, looking and searching for what a higher power has chosen to reveal to a group of alcoholics, a group of people like us. I just think how fortunate and blessed we are. I'd just like to thank you all again. Thank the Area 72. Thank Dick for the invitation to come here. Thank you all for being who you were all weekend here. And I just, you've being here has changed my life, because I believe every single day that we're on this path, we're not the same person that we were yesterday. You've given me so much this weekend, you'll never know. And I'd like to close by reading a couple of paragraphs from the story Keys to the Kingdom, which I love. It says, AA is not a plan for recovery that can be finished and done with. It's a way of life. And the challenge contained in its principles is great enough to keep any human being striving for as long as he lives. We cannot outgrow this plan. As arrested alcoholics, we must have a program for living that allows for limitless expansion. Keeping one foot in front of the other is essential for maintaining our arrestment. Others may idle in a retrogressive groove without too much danger, but retrogression can spell death for us. However, this isn't as rough as it sounds, as we do become grateful for the necessity that makes us toe the line. And we find that we are compensated for a consistent effort by the countless dividends that we receive. A complete change takes place in our approach to life. Where we used to run from responsibility, we find ourselves accepting it with gratitude that we can successfully shoulder it. Instead of wanting to escape some perplexing problem, we experience the thrill of challenge in the opportunity it affords for another application of AA techniques. And we find ourselves tackling it with surprising vigor. I'm just going to change one word. The last 22 years of my life have been rich and meaningful. I've had my share of problems, heartaches, and disappointments, because that is life. But also, I have known a great deal of joy and a peace that is the handmaiden of an inner freedom. I have a wealth of friends. And with my many AA friends, an unusual quality of fellowship. For to these people, I am truly related. First, through mutual pain and despair, and later, through mutual objectives and newfound faith and hope. And as the years go by, working together, sharing our experiences with one another, and also sharing a mutual trust, understanding, and love, without strings, without obligation, we acquire relationships that are unique and priceless. There is no more aloneness with that awful ache so deep in the heart of every alcoholic that nothing before could ever reach it. That ache is gone and need never return again. Now there is a sense of belonging, of being wanted and needed and loved. In return for a bottle and a hangover, we have been given the keys of the kingdom. Thank you.